Hello and welcome to Databook, a podcast presented by Chief Healthcare Executive. I'm Ron Southwick, Senior Editor of Chief Healthcare Executive. With Databook, we talk to healthcare leaders about technology, innovation, and the transformation of healthcare. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll get started in just a moment. Our guest is Tom Cotter, who spends time thinking about things that would keep some people up at night. Tom is the president and executive director of Healthcare Ready, a nonprofit organization that works with the health sector to prepare for disasters and respond to emergencies. He talks about the need for more data to better understand the supply chain, and he offers advice for healthcare leaders to prepare for disasters. Thank you very much for joining us. We are talking today with Tom Cotter of Healthcare Ready. Tom, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me. Glad to be here.
Why don't we start just by giving a little overview of Healthcare Ready and what the organization does?
Sure. Healthcare Ready is a nonprofit 501c3 organization. We're based in Washington, D.C., and we were founded after Hurricane Katrina to support the coordination and collaboration and information sharing between healthcare sector supply chain entities and the public sector. Obviously, after a natural disaster, there's an infinite amount of opportunity for supply chain disruptions. But what was lacking was the ability for public and private sectors to coordinate effectively, especially around data sharing and information management. So to that end, you know, we get access to cross-sector data from our private sector members and partners, and also with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, ASPR and FDA, among other partners in the federal government. And we're able to analyze that into a useful product for people to use, whether it's patients or emergency managers or public health decision makers. So for example, if we detect a shortage of a specific drug, we will speak to the healthcare facilities to understand what patient impacts there could be. We'll understand from the distributor what potential impacts the logistics of moving these drugs or medical devices around are. And then we'll understand from the manufacturers what are the factors that are causing this potential disruption. So as you know, shortages are usually caused by either increased demand or by supply chain issue. So it's upstream or downstream, and understanding the underlying cause is key to making sure that we're either responding or mitigating the effects of this so that patients never feel the disruption. The reality is there's supply chain disruptions every day. And probably since I started talking, there's been 12 more that have popped up. But patients rarely see the effects of this unless they're really exacerbated by other causes. So if there is a supply chain issue, for example, this is that upstream, forgetting the demand side, we can speak to other companies that make substitutions and say, are you able to surge your manufacturing to account for a particular shortage that another company in your field is experiencing? We can work with the federal government to understand if there's other assets that they can, the other levers that they can pull to mitigate a shortage. And then we can track and communicate all of this to medical facilities. So if they have additional stocks, they're preparing and they're leveraging their warehousing and stockpiles accordingly, including to the individual provider who can say, listen, I need to find substitutions for this one drug that is now in shortage to treat patients. So we try to provide and collect information and analysis all from whatever is dug from the earth to as a raw material all the way down to when a provider provides that prescription to a patient.
Well, you talked about supply chain shortages, and there's one drug shortage that's getting a lot of attention now, the shortage of a key asthma drug that a lot of people rely on too. So what's the takeaway there? I mean, obviously there's supply chain shortages that happen, but you know, over the pandemic, we've seen some key drugs and materials that have been in much shorter supply. Like in the bigger picture, what needs to be done to create more resilience in the supply chain?
There's a lot of factors there, and it's a tough, there's kind of general terms and overall themes that we can talk about, but the supply chain at the end of the day is more of a supply web. And there's a lot of interdependencies. There's a lot of different factors and stakeholders, I think more than any of us kind of think about in a normal way. And so if we look at the shortage of a specific formulation of albuterol, which I think is what you're referencing, it's a really good example of this. So one of the a company with a 2% market share goes out of business suddenly and unexpectedly and abruptly. And they make a specific formulation in a specific dosage of albuterol, for example. What we have to do then is understand how can the market absorb this? How can the market absorb this shortage? Now, could be exacerbating again. Whenever this is released, I want to make sure people know where to go to find up-to-date information on this. By the time your listeners are hearing this come out of my mouth, I want to make sure I'm not causing a run on the markets. We can understand what is going on in the context of there was already a shortage of albuterol. So now this is a compounding effect. So to answer your question directly, what we need to do better to create more resiliency up and down the supply chain is a fewfold. One is we need to get an understanding of who's in the supply chain. Who are the key actors in the supply chain? Who are the key people who have significant market shares, for all of the different products. And this is not just albuterol. This is everything from children's ibuprofen, which in the winter of 2022, 2023, we saw an artificial run on because of the pediatric respiratory infections that were going around the country. Then we need to understand where is the data that is useful for decision makers to take action. So there's not... I think people think there's more visibility than there and transparency than there actually is in the supply chain, especially in the healthcare sector. There's a lot of reasons why businesses want to protect that data, and a lot of them are legitimate. There's antitrust and competitive reasons, but there are a lot of business cases for ensuring there are minimized supply chain disruptions and greater supply chain resiliency. So businesses come to this with really good faith, I've found, and are able to provide a certain amount of data. Now there's another question. Who gets to have that data? Who gets to have the transparency on that data? And I think that's what puts Healthcare Ready at a particularly interesting position, because as a 501c3, you know, our interest is making sure that patients never feel the effects of this. We're also, because of our status as a 501c3, can communicate very, very well and without any restrictions, really, with the federal government, state government, local government. And we're also a trusted entity for a lot of private sector partners. So a lot of times we find ourselves in a position where we're able to collect data that otherwise would not be available to all of the stakeholders cross sector and provide that analysis so that the effects are mitigated. Now, there's a lot of other findings. You know, we could talk a little bit about, you know, the findings from COVID-19, just in time, just in case. What I think is interesting, though, in terms of supply chain resiliency is seeing how the restructuring of the public health institutions in the U.S. are really focusing on supply chain now. USHHS ASPR just released their new org chart, and I think there's something like three departments now that address supply chain. One of them is HCORE that focuses this is the Operation Warp Speed, but being institutionalized, HCORE. There's one called IBX, which is talking about onshoring and understanding the manufacturing process around public health entities. And then there's the Strategic National Stockpile, which is now a household name, and I won't go into that. So I think there's a lot of different factors here and a lot of different variables. What I am encouraged by is the focus on it. I think what we need to now do in general, at a high level, is make sure we're institutionalizing the lessons learned from the past couple of years, and not just from COVID-19, but also from the Mpox outbreak, from the pediatric surge outbreak, and the others.
Well, I think you've touched on a couple already, but I really wanted to talk about the report that was just released to Congress that Healthcare Ready did, protecting national public health and healthcare infrastructure for the next disaster. What are the key takeaways that you're hoping lawmakers and policymakers are taking from that report?
Ultimately, there was four main takeaways, and you can find this on our website at healthcareready.org. This report was delivered to HHS and Congress, as you said. This was actually commissioned before COVID-19, which I think is really interesting. And as we were writing it, because it took a couple of years to write, we found a lot of validation. So the four key takeaways are, there's four recommendations to improve communication and coordination across public and private sector, but also across public and public sector, making sure that there's good coordination between CDC, FDA, DHS, Department of Homeland Security, and ASPR, HRSA, and pick an acronym, making sure that there's good communication there to make sure that objectives are aligned, to make sure efforts are aligned to increase efficiency. But also the public and private partnerships were a major success story, I think, during COVID-19. Were they perfect? No. Not even close, but there's a lot of baby in that bathwater. And so I hope that we can keep some of that, those coordination mechanisms, those communication mechanisms between public and private sector. Then there's the strengthening accountability. So ensuring that the monitoring and evaluation of public health interventions, especially on the preparedness and response sides, are aligned across government, and make sure there's alignment with business interests. Because by and large, businesses do not want supply chain shortages or disruptions. That's counterintuitive to the market. So there's a lot of willingness to contribute into a more sustainable supply chain. And then it's strengthen efforts to apply an equity lens. I think what we found, one of the lessons learned on the supply chain side was we can't just count supply chain from raw material down to facility. We really need to go that last inch into when this gets into a patient's body as a part of a treatment. We found things like for example, the monoclonal antibodies. That application of this pretty effective treatment was not equitably distributed. And it's not necessarily that it wasn't distributed to low-income areas and high-income areas, but also the communication of providers who are providing care to historically underserved populations, for example. And so there was less uptake of these available drugs. So that's what I mean. But when I say we need to do that last inch, and a lot of that is also communication. And then, as you might expect, we need to have increased funding for all things public health preparedness. If we look at the period after 9/11, there was so much preparedness funding for an international terror to mitigate and eliminate the risk from international terrorism. And I think we're in that moment now where we need to take the lessons learned from that period of time and apply them here, increased accountability, following the science of it, but also increasing our engagement with private sector from the public's perspective. So overall, I think what I hope is taken away is this is a report that is delivered every so years, every time the popper, papa, papaya, other, however it's called, every couple of years it's renewed. What I really hope we get to is to make sure that the same recommendations are not the exact same in 5 years or 4 years when this is going to be rewritten as an assessment. So I really hope that these actions are acted upon. I hope lessons learned are operationalized and not just talked about, so that we really are making headway across sectors on the threats that we face.
I'd be curious to get some of your input on your advice for hospitals and healthcare leaders. Obviously, they've been dealing with the pandemic for 3 years now. Mm-hmm. They've had to launch whole new different deliveries of care. They've obviously learned a lot of lessons, but there are some that say there are probably some other things where there are still improvements to be made. What would your advice be to hospitals and health systems to be prepared as much as possible for the next pandemic or the next emergency?
I think the number one recommendation I'll make, and this kind of relates to what I was just saying, is get your lessons learned on paper, put them in an improvement plan, and operationalize them. Find out what you can do and find out what you cannot do. The things you can do, the way that you interact with your manufacturers, having resiliency mechanisms like group purchasing power, sharing resources amongst and communicating amongst healthcare coalitions to ensure good and equitable supply across a geography or a community. Those are all things that are no cost, low cost. Things that are going to cost more money are things that you should be advocating for support on, support from the federal, state, and local government, making sure that we're incentivizing the various tools and mechanisms, including on the technology side. How do you communicate your, for example, one of the issues that we saw, let me get specific here. One of the issues that we saw during the pediatric respiratory surge event last winter was the inability for any particular healthcare consortium or healthcare system to accurately communicate bed availability for pediatric patients. And it sounds very easy, but one of the stumbling points was, how do you define a pediatric bed? For the way that a good chunk of the country does it, is it's licensed bed. You are licensed to have X number of beds, and then there's the assumption, well, then you should have that number of beds. But what it doesn't account for is all of the staffing shortages, all of the shortages on pediatric medical devices. And so there's some things that you can't do that you really need to be engaged on. You need to be engaging your state, local officials, and you need to have that pathway and those mechanisms to provide feedback and to provide direct asks all the way, you know, through our hospital preparedness program, our HPP programs, and then also through our local governments as well. That engagement is going to make sure that there are resources and investments to support you as you create more resiliency within your healthcare systems. The last thing I want to say is I think that as a country, we're really fluent in speaking about hospitals at the tertiary and secondary level care. But what I think we're often lacking is the role that primary healthcare plays in supply chain resiliency. For most people, for most Americans, and for most people around the world, primary healthcare providers and even pharmacists are the touch point into the healthcare infrastructure. And so I think we need to spend some more time making sure that we're providing appropriate resources to secondary and tertiary level care, but make sure we're not forgetting primary healthcare clinics, including community health centers and free and charitable clinics. One of the things that's going away is, or potentially going away, is the ability for pharmacists to operate at the top of their licenses. Same thing with nurses and doctors and other things that provide additional access to healthcare infrastructure like telemedicine. These things are in danger with the public health emergency declaration going away later this year. I want to make sure, you know, to your point about what advice I would give, advocate for yourself and advocate, make sure you're communicating what good this does for the communities, and ensure that you are fighting for the resources you can get, because there is a moment here where everyone is on the same page by and large that we need more investment, we need more support of our healthcare providers and healthcare systems.
I really like that you talked about, at least in hospitals, to some no cost, low cost solutions, because I also wanted to ask about maybe some suggestions for smaller hospitals, because it's one thing to have like a large hospital system where it's not even matters as much as money, but you've got a team where you can say, okay, spend some time and study this. A smaller hospital is just trying to take care of the patients that are coming through the door. They have a different challenge. So any advice for smaller systems that just don't have the manpower to maybe do some of the things that some bigger systems can?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and it speaks to my previous point where we do focus a lot on kind of larger systems. We at Healthcare Ready, we've developed a set of resources for community health centers and other smaller clinical operations and facilities to increase the resilience. Things like how to join a GPO, a group purchasing entity that allows you to ensure greater purchasing power, greater visibility, and more buffers within your system. Ways that you can also leverage your communications and your relationships with your manufacturing to understand if there is a shortage, have your non-traditional suppliers at the ready. Diversify the mechanisms and the partners that you have in terms of vendors that can provide critical lists. Make sure you're planning for your critical functions and what are your list of absolute must-haves, and focus on those and triage, because everything can be improved. But if you triage effectively based on your core operations and your continuity of operations planning, you can prioritize with some effort what you need to stay operating 100% for the community. And that includes involving providers in this process. You just talked about kind of people, the people power aspect of this. I think it's really important that you involve healthcare providers themselves, physicians and nurses, and others in the planning stages, so that you can better identify opportunities to provide, alternative care, not alternative care standards, not ACS, but substitutions in different drugs and mechanisms. So I think that's a way to kind of that's a way to have a force multiplier on limited resources at smaller facilities. I would, again, this is a small plug, but take a look at our website, healthcareready.org. We have a lot of resources that we partnered with both clinics and private sector partners that support clinics like the Centene Foundation to develop these tools that are no cost, low cost, because we know how important that is. Not everyone can implement an AI machine learning solution for your supply chain, although it would be great if we could get there. So we try to focus on partners of every size.
Well, how much of a solution is technology to helping improve preparedness? Because you talked about using AI in terms of getting better insights into supply. Is moving forward technology, health systems aren't always the fastest adopters of new technology. How important is that to start embracing technology, AI, automation, in terms of being more prepared for the next disaster?
I think it's critical. I think it's critical, but I also understand the hesitancy. The reason the space shuttle was flown on the same OS from the 1960s until it was retired is because it worked. And when you have a critical system like a space shuttle or a healthcare system, you really don't want to try to fix what isn't broken necessarily. But I think this investment and this, and I don't just mean in money, but also in time and effort and as you said, people power is critical. We've developed a couple tools to help things like using, I think the data information, the data management and visualization and communication is critical. So investing in that in ways that are usable for decision makers. A couple of products that we've developed based on available data is what happens to pharmacies after a hurricane. We have a tool called RX Open. So what this does is leverage relationships and data from pharmacies and pharmacy facilities, from self-reporting, but also from, is their finance system up and running? Is their financial processing? Is their credit card machine working? Then we know they're operating. So how do we get all this data and put it in a way that's useful? And so we've developed this tool called RX Open. A couple other tools that we've used, I mentioned the pediatric bed availability maps. Taking that and putting it into a reporting mechanism that allows you to communicate this as a need, as a vulnerability, so that you can get additional resources, I think is critical. But then I think the biggest investment around technology in mitigating any supply chain disruptions or shortages is really invest in ways that you can communicate to government, to partners, to manufacturers. And this has to be a two-way street as well. One of the things that we always try to do is make sure that we're not just asking for data from our health facilities and healthcare partners, but making sure that we're communicating what we're getting from the federal and manufacturing and healthcare distribution side as well. So there's a lot of technology around making sure that is routine, making sure it's clean, making sure it's standardized. And again, none of that is particularly high cost. It just takes some resources and some investment in time.
One last question, because I know we have to wrap up, but I was just curious, since you spent some time studying the strengths and weaknesses of preparedness and response, do you have a lot of sleepless nights after taking such a deep dive in this? I mean, does this keep you up at night, or do you maybe sleep a little better now that you have a better sense of some of the improvements we've made?
I will answer that and say yes to both. You know, I think understanding the interdependencies and how potentially fragile our system is worrisome. But what I think is what allows me to finally put my my head on a pillow is this has been tested. This was tested for the last 3 years. And something that supply chain people like to say is that the system bent, but it did not break. We were able to, being the supply chain and as a public health professional and responder myself, we were able to meet a lot of the needs, you know, with regard, you know, keeping in mind the context in which we were doing it, a new vaccine, you know, new science coming out every day. There was a lot of successes for the past 3 years around the supply chain when that was not a given. And so I think moving forward is making sure, again, we're capturing those successes. Why was this successful? How can we modify this to not be focused on COVID-19 and to be an all hazards resiliency exercise? I sleep okay. Honestly, I sleep okay. I think I see a lot of intentional process to making sure that all the impacts of whatever's coming next, because something is going to come next, will be mitigated. I'm encouraged. I'm encouraged by the conversations and by the willingness amongst public and private partners to really spend a lot of time thinking, discussing, and implementing changes.
Well, this wraps up the time we have. Tom, thanks so much for a very important and very informative discussion and an enjoyable one too. So I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Ron. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for joining Databook, a podcast presented by Chief Healthcare Executive, a brand of MGH Life Sciences. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. For the latest news, analysis, and insights on healthcare, visit our website, chiefhealthcareexecutive.com. You can follow us on social media on LinkedIn and Twitter. I'm Ron Southwick, Senior Editor of Chief Healthcare Executive. Thanks again for joining us. Take care.